Okay, great. Good morning, and Anesh, thanks very much for the invitation to present here. Pretty excited to show you some of the work we're up to in Cherries. I'd like to acknowledge Dave Jabot. He's a postdoc in my lab. He's done quite a bit of the analyses here. Ryan Contreras, I was remiss in my haste to get my title into you to include Ryan, but Ryan did quite a bit of the cytometry work with us, and of course had the instrument in his lab, so he was quite critical to this work. And then Matthew Whiting, of course, at Washington State University. So the growth analysis work that we've been doing had some pretty clear objectives from the outset. We really wanted to understand a bit more about growth and development with the hopes of identifying sources of variability that might limit fruit growth, with the goal of facilitating preemptive crop management strategies. You know, there are lots of times in cherries we have new varieties, they're very productive, they're on precocious rootstocks, and it's hard to know if you're going to need to do some crop load management, at what point you can do it. We don't have enough work, background work in cherry to make those decisions. Another objective would be to synchronize growth regulators, uses of and types of growth regulators with growth stages in development. But there are quite a bit of challenges in looking at growth, as I've listed a few of them. The first of which is separating unfertilized or failed growth from the fruits that are going to go through to harvest. It's quite difficult if you're trying to look at growth potential in that early stage after bloom, when you've got fruit that are going to drop and they're carrying on at a similar growth rate. They may have less, but if you're less growth may be accumulated, but if you're randomly sampling along the way, it's really difficult to sort those out. The double sigmoid growth pattern, there's been work in stone fruit, and these references are specific to cherry, that lag phase is dependent on environment. And there's been some work around since the 50s that suggested we should really be looking at two phases, not three, and we'll show you a little bit of why that makes sense. And then the minimum size asymptote is at dormancy, not at bloom. So a lot of growth curves are forced to, you know, zero at bloom, and it's just not the case. And so looking at all of this and the idea that you need a lot of samples and a high frequency of sampling to really put together a strong growth curve. And so I think I'll start with what we looked at the first few years in terms of growth and how we're looking at sweet cherry fruit growth, and then kind of break down components of this curve and show you how we derived different experiments to get the data. So you're looking at natural log volume. And, you know, there are many reasons why we would look at that. Of course, it represents growth of biological organisms very well. But it allows us to capture many orders of magnitude of growth and put them on the same curve. So we can do a lot more with that. We've got a relative growth curve. That's a squiggly guy going through here, which gives us a good idea of the growth potential, maximum growth potential. And we've got some bud work here, and then these are just ovaries pre-bloom, coming up through flowering, and going all the way through. We also have some work that's going to highlight the unfertilized fruit, so we can show you how we can drop those out, and now we're only going to be looking at the growth of fruit that are going to make it all the way to the end. Okay, so pre-anthesis, we've done quite a bit of work in growth with pre-bloom ovaries, which were photographed. We did all this work on photos. So we imaged these. We were able to estimate volumes from our images. And then we also did a lot of correlation work with weights as we continued along. The data are fit to polynomial curve. And you can see all along the way, we sort of were aware of the phenology stages, so we could capture what's happening with phenology. And you can see that the ovary and the bud, in terms of growth, are pretty well in step. But what you see on the relative growth rate analysis is that, you know, at dormancy, these guys take off. They have a nice jump in growth. And then as the bud grows and, you know, once you hit the green tip and you go into tight cluster, the bud sort of comes apart, can't do the measurements anymore. And then you see this sharp rise in growth of the ovary. That's that sort of exponential phase that you kind of consider with stage one of growth, but it's happening consistently at 14 days or so before bloom. You know, interestingly, one thing we wanted to look at was the variability. And if you look at the variability, if you're familiar with cherry and you harvest, you got a range of fruit sizes, big, small. It's amazing the amount of variability. It's nearly 100%. But it's quite consistent across this curve. And this is a 95% prediction limit. And you can see, look at the variability when you're at 50, 60 days bloom. Relative growth rate analysis would tell you that those small fruit will never be big. The big fruit will always be big. And if you really want to get at limiting that variability, well, in some respect, it starts by understanding what's happening back here. Okay, so post-flowering experimental design, we had a few different experiments that we laid out for this. So the first was to try to get a sense of the anthesis timing, because part of that variability can be explained by effects of crop load, and part of it can be explained by flower timing. You know, not everything blooms at the same time. We know that the earlier blooming, more developed, advanced flowers, if they're fertilized, are going to be bigger. They have bigger ovaries. We've done that work. And so it's challenging in this work to try to set the stage so we can understand or remove that some of those variability. Okay, so what we did with the timing of flowering is that we went into clusters and we at the balloon stage, we used lab tape and we taped the pedicel. We also went in and did the same thing, but we thinned, and that's what you would see down in this picture right here. So everything at balloon, we removed everything else that was either advanced or delayed. And next day we came back, anything that, you know, wasn't open yet, of those we got rid of. And so we could set that flower timing at more or less one day. And then we could compare that to a range where we selected, you know, we just randomly sampled, you know, as we went. Every other day through the entire season, randomly sample. And we can compare what would just be a range of fruits that come from the flower timing to what was set. We also did that in a thinned and unthinned condition. And then to get at these unfertilized fruits, we used bee exclusion netting. So we could get a growth curve on those, and that's what you're looking at here. And, the growth doesn't appear, the curves don't appear to significantly separate themselves until about 20 days or so. So this is that difficult portion of the growth curve where if you're randomly sampling, you know, could be failed, could not be. So we used a statistical analysis called discriminant analysis to separate out those that were failed or not fertilized from those that were going to make it. And essentially, there's a little bit of text. I won't read it verbatim, but it's using variables to classify these observations as belonging to one group or another. In our case, we wanted to know what was failed and what wasn't. And it turned out in the analysis that the significant variables were days from bloom, aspect ratio, and the shape of the cherry told us a lot during that stage, and of course the log volume. And this is what this looks like. And you can see that at 20 days from bloom, we're able to pull out now those fruit that were bagged, and then using discriminant analysis, take out everything else that's falling into that category versus the growth curves that we have of that go all the way through to harvest. The nice thing about this is we could separate these much earlier than we're doing fruit crop load estimates. You know, it might be 30, 40 days, and here we're looking at about 20 days where we can pull these out. So I talked about number. Each one of these curves has about 6,000 fruit. So you can't really get a good strong curve unless you have the fruit numbers. And you can see again the variability, how consistent it is from dormancy all the way to the end. We looked at three cultivars. This is the model. We used Chelan, Bing, and Sweetheart. And one was an early season, Chelan, Bing's mid, Sweetheart's late. Looking at this variation in development, trying to figure out, you know, what it might be attributed to in growth. And as it turned out, the cultivars behave very similarly until the final growth stage. The only difference in those three cultivars was the duration of the stage three growth. Everything else more or less happened at the same time, and I'll show you a little more about that. Once we pull those data out that are failed, which would be this portion of the curve, if you look at the center curve, we could then anchor the data with the dormancy measures and use polynomial fits to connect those two. So then we can actually get a strong sense via a function what's happening with fruit that are going to make it all the way through time. Okay, so we did a little bit of crop load management. That would be the top figures here, panels. This would be Sweetheart. And you can see here we're just showing growth mainly through phase three. These polynomials that we fit, they're not asymptotic, so you can see we also put these logistic functions to the end of the growth curve there. And what you see here is this is in a natural condition, and we did not have a heavy crop load this year. It was only about seven, eight fruit per spur. That's really not that much. And you can see just in that condition a difference in the set and the range. So the set, of course, we control the timing of flowering, so you don't have all of those other guys' late blooms and whatnot pulling the curve down, and that's why you see a difference in the growth there. This would be in a thin condition. They were larger, the fruit were larger as you would expect, and we pulled out some of that variation that would be attributed here to crop load, because you've got a whole bunch of factors going on. These aren't thinned, and you can see how this sort of comes together a bit more. Bing and Chelan, we didn't do crop load adjustment with, but you can again see the effects of crop load and flower timing in these wide differences. Now you have to remember this is log volume scale, so some differences that don't appear to be so large are. We feel that pit growth really drives fruit growth, and so it's the when pits stop growing, which is about 35 days, we're at the end of the first growth phase. That's it. So the pits really set the stage. That second growth phase that we isn't really much growth going on in terms of the mesocarp, that we call that sort of pit hardening phase. It really isn't a phase at all. It's dependent on environment. We've got some years where you can blow right through that without a little lag at all, and some years where it kind of lags for quite a while. Pit growth, on the other hand, is pretty constant at 30 days. Crop load did result in thinning, result in larger pits. Again, on a log transform curve, you can't really see that, but it was significant. Okay, lots of numbers here. It's not really important necessarily to look at all of these, but the idea is using functions, we can then look at inflection points on the curve and figure out when things are happening. And so if we looked at Sweetheart, Bing, and Chelan, we could pretty much come up with the fact that they didn't significantly differ through all of these phases until the very end, of course, and then you've got some big differences in that final growth phase. So the old, you know, way of looking at this might be phase one cell division starting at bloom. Of course, that's not the case. 50% of the cells in cherry fruit are laid down at bloom. They're already there. They only really go through one round of cycling, and I'll show you what that looks like. A phase two pit hardening, but we feel quite strongly that there's really two phases of growth. And if you really want to get a handle on the sharp rise in cell division and growth, it's all pre-bloom, you know, nearly entirely. Okay, so that led into some flow cytometry objectives. At the time, we were looking at cytometry to complement the microscopy work we were doing, mainly to see if we can figure out the division phase. And the goal there was to understand, you know, cell number, cell size, how does that relate to final fruit size. Jim Olmsted and Amy and Matt did some work on that, and there's been some other stuff, but we wanted to see all along how this works, and we thought cytometry would be real nice. We could peg that rest phase of cell division, and then once it lets go, you know, we'd have a return to diploid cells more or less, and we'd be on our way. We also wanted to use it for some cultivar comparisons. Now, most of the work that's been done in this process of endoreduplication, which is nuclear divisions without cell division, typically occurs after mitosis, has been done in tomato. That's been the model for looking at endoreduplication. And here you just see, you know, nice growth curves. Here they start at bloom, but you've got fruit diameter and relative growth, and then cell volume. And the cell volume curves we've generated from cherry look exactly like the fruit growth curve. You know, they follow the same exact route. The cells are increasing in size all along. That makes sense. Now here are the data on in terms of fruit age are plotted against the mean C value of the pericarp cells, and I'll show you a little bit of what that looks like in tomato. And then on the right, or my right, we've got number of cycles. And one thing again is that you can see at the bottom of the curve, it's not easy explaining what's happening down here. And of course, this is a really interesting stage for cell cycling, mitosis, divisions, etc. And it gets a little complicated. So as I mentioned in tomato, the growth of the fruit is reflected quite well in the pericarp. We think that cherry is a much nicer model to follow in terms of studying cell cycling and reduplication, because 95% of the fruit's parenchyma. I mean, you're looking at, you know, the mesocarp is 95% of the fruit as opposed to the pericarp. But I suppose the pericarp, you know, is quite well linked with fruit size. So that's what that first two boxes, that's what they show, is essentially fruit diameter against endoreduplication index. And I'll show you how that's derived. But essentially, tomato can really crank it out. I mean, four rounds of endoreduplication and quite large C values for these cells. The lower panel just shows mean cell size against endoreduplication index. And the idea is more DNA in the cells, the bigger the cells. You know, we were really interested in this idea because with cherry, we wanted to get a sense of what was driving fruit growth, and we were still doing all this modeling. We had this cytometry data, and we thought, oh, maybe we'll be able to pick out some of these differences. We're at 18 minutes? That's not good. Okay, these panels to the right are just showing the relative fruit growth rate, and then this is the relative endoreduplication rate, the cell production rate, and you can see how these two combine to match the relative growth rate quite well. When endoreduplication really starts picking up, it really defines the end of the cell division period. So you can see here the 2C are dropping down sharply. This end here, and you can see the 4C start dropping, and then all the higher C values start increasing in terms of the cells over time. Anish, I don't know if you're going to describe some of your work, but you've done some quite nice work here with apple, looking at pre-bloom increase in cell layers, post-bloom cell production being pollination dependent, and really interestingly and very different from cherry is this cell layer that you know, 4 to 5 times the cell divisions, unlike cherry, which we've only got 2 rounds that really take place. Again, I mentioned that cherry tissue is 95% parenchymous. And so when we're looking at the fruit, we have a very good model to relate to cell cycling. So we used standard DAPI stain nuclei, 1,000 counts of nuclei. You can see that cycle value. That's how we estimate the rounds. You can look at sort of a mean or an average C value, but it doesn't seem to tell us much, especially when you have high C values, about what's happening. Okay, cherry's diploid species, things are pretty well conserved around 2 and a little bit of 4C. The fruit, as it turns out, are polyploid, and they just keep on going. This just shows the ovary volume of Chelan, Bing, and Sweetheart over time. And here we have log transform data. And again, these X's and O's are the failed fruit we pulled out by discriminant analysis. This is the mean cycle value in cherry, so it's fourfold less than it would be in tomato. And you could see we couldn't separate Chelan, Bing, and Sweetheart. They all kind of fall on the same line. If you look at the mean cycle value, it's linear with ovary volume. This was our indication that things are fruit are getting bigger, cells more endoreduplication, bigger cells, maybe bigger fruit have this potential based on the cell cycling. And if we put the ploidy percent over time, again, you see this 8C really pops up down here at the first growth maxima, the relative growth rate maxima, still in phase one. That's what this is, phase one of growth. So this really defines the end of mitosis, and reduplication is picking up. It sets the stage for big cells, but you'll see in a lot of the data there's quite a big amount of variability in terms of just because you've got a higher sea level, you can still have small cells, so there's more involved. Cherry is quite unique in the sense that we have this sigmoidal growth pattern relative to something like tomato, and you can see an uncoupling of this endo cycle rate with fruit size. And that's shown quite clearly here with the endo cycle rate against this jump here. So they're not linked, they're not coupled. As I mentioned, 50% of the cells in cherry are already laid down at bloom. The cell divisions are over at 14 days or so from bloom. And if you look at this cell production rate here versus the endoreduplication rate and the growth, it would follow what's happening in tomato quite well. It happens early. These cells are over early. They don't. You could see the lag phase and endoreduplication and cell cycling. And I think I'll leave with this. We've got a few more slides, but I want to exceed my time limit here. But there's some beautiful work that's been done using this technique called FISH, where you take, this is the tomato pericarp, and here all the cell layers are laid out, and this technique allows for endoreduplication index, ploidy counts, and you can see the great relationship between cell size, endoreduplication. But here's the variability. Look at that. You know, 64C, you got big and small cells. It's pretty pronounced. We're interested in this in cherry, and we've got data to show this variation in size across time as the cherry develops. But look at that. You get these cells in cherry, and we use the vascular bundles as a reference point when we're doing some our cell counts, and this is the mesocarp right here, and look at the size of a cell like that. It'd be wonderful if you knew what was controlling that, cell cycle genes, and you could get a sense of what's going on there to breed into to potentially larger fruit size. We've got a lot of data on shape of cells over time, but I won't get into that, and I'll leave you with this last slide, which is some nice work on cereal sectioning and tomato, and essentially using these type of data to reconstruct a 3D model of fruit, which we're sort of at the end of our limits, I think, in terms of the kind of detail we can get when we're putting all of these things together, and I think we need to go to a little bit more of an interesting model. But for now, that's what I've got. I appreciate your attention.